The Guardian.
Hi everybody, this is The Guardian Football Weekly, the Premier League review. Manchester City reach 100 points, Mo Salah reaches a Premier League goals record, and Arsene Wenger reaches the end. In the Championship playoffs, it's advantage Derby Villa. In Europe, Barcelona's invincible season comes undone at the penultimate hurdle, and Juve's title is confirmed. We'll bring you that, plus questions, feedback corner, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. We have a panel today. Amy Lawrence, it's lovely to see you.
Hi, Max.
It doesn't happen often enough.
No, I'm here.
It's lovely to see you. And a good day to have you.
Thanks.
It's all right. How's your arm?
Slow.
Yeah.
Grumpy.
You came in with a tubey grip the last time.
I did.
And like those sort of, like Bert Trautman. That was what you've been like that for the last 6 months.
Yeah, well, I learned... If you ever go to a doctor and you've done that self-diagnosis thing beforehand, thinking, yeah, I've got this all under control, and then you go and see the doctor and they make you feel about a millimetre tall by saying, so, you know, why didn't you come and get this checked out? Oh, yeah, because I thought it was absolutely nothing. And turned out I was walking around for 6 weeks with a broken wrist and ruptured tendon in my thumb. And, I more than anything else, I nearly fell on the floor and re-injured myself in shock because I am the biggest southern softie I know. So the idea that I could have...
You're hard as nails.
Well, hey, shucks.
Hey, Nick Ames.
Hey, Max Weston.
How are you?
I'm really well.
Is it unfair of me to imagine that if you broke your arm, it would put you out of action for a while? Or are you tougher than...
No, I'd be out of action. I once broke somebody's arm accidentally, actually, when I was a teenager.
How? Oh, with a hammer?
There was a bit of tomfoolery in a playing field in Ipswich. I pushed a boy. You know that thing where somebody would like crouch down and then you'd push someone over them?
Oh, as they went backwards?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And I got in a world of trouble.
Oh, really?
More from my mum than his mum, actually.
Barry?
I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
Good for you, Vaz. How did it feel?
It was great.
Yeah, I bet it was. Question one goes to Nick Ames. Premier League, a good one?
I don't think it's been a very good one. It's just an opinion, just a hot take I'm going to put out there. One really good team, one fantastic team, Manchester City. And then... not a great deal of competition. Then an absolute morass between places 9 and 20, which you could throw up in the air next season and they'd all fall maybe in the reverse positions and nobody would really bat an eyelid. And I'm saying that we're all talking here from the perspectives of people who get paid to watch this stuff and really privileged to do so. So I'm not going to say it's not been a lot of fun, because it has. But I think quality-wise, it's been a big disappointment overall.
But it's the best league in the world.
But the thing is as well, it depends where you're making that assessment from. I mean, yesterday at Huddersfield, those fans, it's the best season that any of them can ever remember. They don't think it was a rubbish Premier League season. They had an incredible time going around, proud of their team, some memorable performances such as beating Manchester United and getting, you know, the point to stay up at Chelsea. I think Brighton and Hove Albion would regard this season, I mean, obviously I'm talking here about the promoted teams who have stayed up, but you know, if you're just looking at it from the point of view, was there a competition at the top end of the table? And no, there wasn't. And the middle was a little bit, well, the middle is usually a bit iffy, you would imagine. I don't think it was kind of that catastrophic.
Manchester City got 100 points.
They did, yes.
What is more impressive to you, a 100-point season or an invincible season?
I would say an invincible season is more impressive. Arsenal, their invincible season is still talked about. Barcelona probably a bit gutted that they haven't pulled one off, but... yeah, 100 points is very impressive. You know, there's no getting away from that. Sort of going back to your original question, I think the Premier League is often billed as the best in the world because it's the most competitive, but the truth of the matter is, because City were so good, it wasn't competitive, and it hasn't been competitive for a few years now. I mean, even the year Leicester won it, they won it at a pretty much a canter. And then... the gulf from Burnley down, you know, the gulf in quality between the top six and the rest is getting bigger and bigger, you know. And we were in a situation where Burnley went 11 games either side of Christmas without winning, and I don't think they even dropped a place, maybe dropped one place, and that kind of spoke volumes. But I still enjoyed it because Man City were really good to watch, and the relegation battle was quite interesting. And I'm always a bit, I don't know what it says about me, but I'm always more enthused by a good relegation dogfight than I am by a title fight. And probably because I support a team that's never really involved in a title shake-up.
Manchester City, do you want to hear all of their records? Most consecutive wins, 18. The previous record was 13, was Chelsea in 2016-17. Their most goals, 106. Best goal difference, plus 79. Most wins, 32. Most away wins, 16. Most away points, points ahead of second. Interestingly, pretty much Chelsea are in second place in all of these records, and not in the same year. Looking at these records for Man City mainly makes me think, actually, it's quite good to be a Chelsea fan, because you might have these weird seasons like this year, but then next year you might have a good one.
Maybe. I don't think they're thinking that at the moment, and I think we'll come to Chelsea. But what I really liked actually yesterday about Man City, what was the celebrations at the end when Gabriel Jesus scored? I mean, I'm sure many of you have seen it. Really cute finish, lovely takedown and lob,
yeah,
in the final minute of Southampton. And that game could have been a dead duck. Took them over the 100-point barrier. And the celebrations at the end from Guardiola and his staff were absolutely exuberant, weren't they? Ecstatic. You could see what it meant to them and what that achievement was. So I guess when we say, oh, not competitive, we have to recognise the achievement and the fact they were still striving for it at the end.
I had the pleasure of going to see Vincent Kompany a couple of weeks back, and I asked him, you know, do the records matter, you know, when you've won the league? You know, do these extra sort of embellishments actually make you tick as a footballer? And he sort of looked at me as if it was a totally idiotic question, and like, well, of course they're hugely significant. And I think some players are less driven by those sort of extra things, you know. All that matters is the piece of silverware, the medal around your neck. But he gave the impression that really a lot of that came direct from Pep, and said that Guardiola is, you know, what makes him unique, apart from the kind of obviously the way that he can build these teams to play aesthetic, beautiful, you know, compelling football. Is this, he says, that his inner drive is sort of unlike anybody. It's like a super drive, and that it's every day you've got to be striving for the next thing. And there's sort of no relaxing, sort of really tolerated. It seemed to be the impression that he was given, and that, you know, the training session after you won the league is kind of the most important one, because you've got to show that you really want to be better. And I think they regarded that 100 points as a proper attainment, even though, yes, it's a footnote in the history books, and in the end, people in X years' time will be remembering that City won the league X seasons out of Y or whatever it is, if they go on to have a period of dominance that we probably all half expect. But to them, it's a signpost that they really, really want to be better next year, and obviously they've been amazing in terms of what they've
Do you think they can be better next year?
Well, I mean, the curious thing will be that they're going to want to take that into the Champions League more, obviously. But they're not going to turn up and think, oh, we can just win the league by default. I think, again, Kompany was saying that day one of next season, he wants to see, a bit like Alex Ferguson used to say when he would walk in the dressing room and look in the eyes of his players, could he see the hunger in there? And that was what Kompany was driving at. He wants to see particularly the younger players in the squad super hungry, with, you know, cranked up desire that what they've got to do next season has to be better than this season.
It's like Brian Clough when he took over at Leeds and sort of said, you know, I want to win the league better. And of course they can be better next season. You know, they can not lose. They can have an invincible season. They have things to aspire to. And I'd imagine that team, it's great fun to play on it. You know, and they will presumably nobody's going to leave unless they're given the boot, you'd imagine, and they can pretty much buy anyone they want to. So there seems to be a presumption that the other teams will improve, but Manchester City won't. And
to make it fair.
Yeah, but I think it's a very spurious assumption to make, because there's absolutely no guarantee that will happen.
But maybe it'll all fall apart when Mikel Arteta leaves. Maybe he's the glue.
Could be.
We'll get on to your feelings about who should be the next Arsenal manager in a bit, Amy. And also, first pod next season, Barry, I want to see the hunger in your eyes.
Let's get through the World Cup first.
Okay. Southampton are safe. Nick, Mark Hughes did what he was brought in for. Will he be there next season? He says, we'll have to wait and see, amongst the number of managers who, you know, could be a completely different set of managers, really, next season.
I mean, I think he should be there next season. I think the thing with Mark Hughes is that, because he doesn't come across as very cuddly, does he? And he's all sort of arms folded and a bit defensive. And actually, our mutual friend Nick Miller made a really good description of him after the game at Swansea the other day, saying he looked like a man who was put out that someone's car had been parked across his driveway, which I thought was a very, very nice way of putting it. And I think he's a bit of a spiky character. He's had bits of aggro here and there before, but if you look at his record, it's good. I think it's good. And he's not performed miracles at Southampton. Let's not pretend that they were down and out and it was a sort of what Darren Moore almost did at West Brom, but he's done enough. He's got players to work with. Why chop and change again a few months later? I think enough Premier League clubs are going to do that this summer. I get a bit tired of it. I think give him next season. He deserves it.
Swansea are down. They lost 2-1 at home to already relegated Stoke. Carvalho reports last week that he'd gone already, and then he's sort of after the game saying, oh, well, I'll have a little, you know, have a meeting this week with the club and see what happens. Should he stay there? The Swansea, it's almost as if they shouldn't have sacked Gary Monk. I don't know how many managers ago that was, in a blind panic. I don't know if they would have. Maybe they would have gone down sooner. Maybe they wouldn't. But that was the end. It seems to be the end of the Swansea way.
Well, there was something of a debate going on in the desk downstairs before we came up here today, whether Carvajal is a complete spoofer, I think is the exact word Nick used.
Or everyone else is nodding.
Or who gets away with many shortcomings, because he comes out with quite amusing analogies and seems like a very nice fellow. But, you know, he got off to a good start and then Swansea went over a cliff. He doesn't seem to be shouldering any of the blame for the relegation whatsoever. He's blaming, you know, lack of transfers during the January window and their poor start to the season. But he is certainly culpable, because some of the football they've been playing for the last few weeks has been absolutely dreadful. Some of the worst I've ever seen in the Premier League. I don't know whether he should stay or not. I know our resident Swansea fan, Ellis James, is a big fan of Carlos and interviewed him for the BBC a couple of weeks ago and completely fell in love with him. So whether or not he's changed his tune now that Swansea have been relegated, I don't know.
I think there's a bit of a pattern there when you compare it to Sheffield Wednesday. I think it was a similar vibe where they adored him to start with. He could, you know, he could walk on water in Sheffield for a period over there, and then it all suddenly began to unravel. And I think he seems to have this kind of quick hit, instant effect, where, you know, new manager syndrome, it lifts everybody and he creates something, and then
he stole Alan Pardew's bounce.
But I think I'd have had a quick hit effect in the Championship if I'd spent £30 or £40 million, which is what he did with Sheffield Wednesday. He'd get to the playoffs a couple of times, mess it up eventually. And I think in his quite lengthy post-match defence of his career yesterday, he brought that up, saying it's really difficult to get to the playoffs twice. It's difficult to get the points I've had in the Premier League this season. I'm just not really having it. Spare us that, especially at the time when Swansea had just gone down and there were more important things to get on with. I think it was a very opportune for him moment to big himself up, but he's not had the career to justify it.
And they'll lose some players. I mean, Fabianski looked distraught, but he's a very good goalkeeper, actually, isn't he? I don't know who else is there that you think would definitely not be there next year.
Apparently Wayne Routledge handed in a transfer request an hour after the game ended.
Is that so?
Mm-hmm. Well, they've not got many, have they? And I mean, the two real stalwarts, Liam Britton and Angel Rangel, I think have both finished now, which is a bit of a shame for the continuity. You know,
they are quite old.
I'd have given Liam Britton a season in the Championship.
Fair enough. Now you start to think of their squad, and
Mawson.
Yeah,
good player, will leave surely, but apart from that.
I didn't predict them to go down, and perhaps I should have done. Barry Womble says, now that Stoke have gone down, which team can we now use for the, I bet he couldn't do that on a wet and windy night in
Watford,
to criticise? It's not north enough, is it? I mean, Burnley, but are Burnley too good? Isn't the idea that you should be able to beat Stoke, but you can't do it?
No. I think it has to be Watford. A wet Wednesday in Watford.
They just won pitch of the year, didn't they? It's got to be like a bog.
Wet Wednesday in Watford. Wet Wednesday in Wolverhampton.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, but
they're going to be too good.
But again, they're too Aureviste, Nouveau Riche, aren't they?
So basically, what Stoke going down means,
deprive us of
it
this,
means, yeah.
This great cliche.
Yeah, got that's
it.
The end.
See,
of the
it would have been West Brom, but they're also gone.
The top four was all confirmed. Spurs finished third after a frankly ridiculous game against Leicester City. A game with an end of season feel about it, or a completely no defending allowed feel about it.
There was nine goals and so many chances missed as well. It was absolutely spectacular.
Well, Jamie Vardy scored the first goal after 4 minutes. A header from a free kick where he was completely unmarked. I literally got some unfathomable amount of space that he was in. I just couldn't work that out.
I think Spurs did have to make a very last-ditch defensive reshuffle, didn't they? I could be wrong here. Didn't Vertonghen get injured just before?
He did. But, you know,
so they might have still been...
At any level of football, you say, one each, lads, at a free kick. And, you know...
Max, you're wasted on this pod.
Well, people have said that before, but I'm not sure. Defensive coach. Yeah. I could be the new Steve Bold, couldn't I? Anyway, look, two for Harry Kane. First Premier League player to score 30 but not win the Golden Boot. He'd won it the previous 2 years with 25 and 29 goals. First Spurs player since Clive Allen to score 40-plus. Jamie Vardy scored two. Got more than 20 goals this season. Could you play them together at the World Cup, Nick?
I mean, if you were playing two up top, yes, it's quite a classic combination, and they're both a bit more multifaceted than big man, little man. But it's not going to happen, and I don't think you'd put Vardy out in one of the wide positions necessarily, would you? But I think they're both fantastic options, and I felt it was good yesterday to see Kane seem to have that little half yard back that he's maybe lacked in the last few weeks. We saw that for his first goal when he got away from the defence especially. I wouldn't force putting them together. I wouldn't change the system for it. But they're both on great form. That second goal by Vardy, the thud with his left foot from an angle, was the sign of a man really confident, I think.
Yeah, Kane's quite subtle, isn't he? He's got a subtlety about him, and Vardy is just, I'm going to kick this as hard as I can. Post-match, Pochettino made some interesting comments. We need to talk a lot, he said. The board, have a clear idea of what we need to do, and I don't know if the club will agree with me or not, but we need to talk next week to create the new project. It's a bit up to Daniel. You need to be brave and take risks. Read between the lines, Barry, or just read the lines.
It's certainly an ultimatum, isn't it? And he has every right to make one because he kind of has Spurs over a barrel. They need him more than he needs them. If he chose to leave, he'd have no shortage of offers. And the fact of the matter is that Spurs are very parsimonious by comparison to most other Premier League clubs. And if he doesn't get what he wants, he'll just walk.
Where will he go? Is there an obvious place for him to go right now, or does that depend if Real Madrid win the Champions League?
Only if Real Madrid got absolutely whacked in the Champions League, well, or lost the Champions League final, possibly, then Zidane could be under a bit of threat, but you can't really see another destination for him. I think whatever happens, he'll be there next season.
Amy, you share that? You think he'll take them into the new stadium as well?
I do, exactly. I think that he has been a big figurehead for this movement of the last few years at Tottenham, where they've been expanding and getting big ideas and improving. It's his team, and it is a big deal when you have that first year in the new stadium. And I think it would be just an absolutely astonishing shock to Tottenham's system if he suddenly wasn't there. I mean, when you say, well, he might walk, I just find that quite difficult to envisage. I think that that first year is almost sacred, and that probably goes for most of the players, apart from the ones that are expected to move on, that have sort of fallen out of favour a bit at Tottenham lately. I would expect most of the big players, if not all of them, plus Pochettino, to do that first season, and that's when it becomes interesting at the end of that first year.
I agree that he will almost certainly be there at the start of next season, but is it losing him a risk Levy will be prepared to take? I mean, he is famed for his brinksmanship when it comes to transfer dealings. So.
It's interesting that Pochettino came out publicly, isn't it? I think. I've not heard him do that often.
I agree. I think that he can only be doing that because he feels the point needs to be out there. I don't think he's just saying something like that just because he thinks it. I think there's a reason behind it.
Yeah,
but whether that's an attempt to just add a bit of pressure to try and make sure that he gets the business he feels he needs.
And we don't quite know what is available to him, do we? There have been various stories that the stadium is going to be quite a lot more expensive than they thought at first. So, you know, what is possible? We don't know, as opposed to what Levy will allow.
They're also going to have a slightly odd start next season anyway, because the likelihood is that they won't have a home game for a bit. They are expected to have to ask for away matches for the first few games of the season, because the stadium is unlikely to be on schedule to open for the beginning of the new campaign. So, and they have to have a couple of kind of ramp up warm up events anyway. So I think they want as much stability as possible, because it's going to be a slightly odd start to next season for them.
Liverpool are fourth, 4-0 win over Brighton. Mo Salah, 44 goals in 51 games for Liverpool in all competitions this season, 32 goals in the Premier League. The record for a 38-game Premier League season was 31. Shearer, Ronaldo and Suarez all got that. Shearer and Andy Cole, Shearer for Blackburn, Cole for Newcastle, jointly hold the record for a 42-match Premier League season of 34. I'm trying to think of a different way of asking the question, is Mo Salah good, or how good is Mo Salah, or will he ever do this again? Or should we just sit back and enjoy what a total pleasure he's been?
I mean, Harry Kane, I think, made probably the most sort of unintentionally waspish comment I've ever heard him make, which was that you've got to see whether Salah can do it consistently, which, you know, I mean, Harry Kane's a nice lad, I think, and I don't think he meant any terrible mind games from it. But, I mean, we do have to see whether he can do it once or twice more, but let's look at this season and enjoy that, because it's been fantastic. And I think in terms of an all-round forward goal-scoring contribution, normally coming in from wide, he's the nearest thing we've had to Cristiano Ronaldo, I think. And I'm not directly comparing them, but there is a comparison to be made positionally and in terms of the explosiveness when you get into the final third as well. What I do like about him, though, is that he's unselfish too. Like, he set up a nice goal for Solanke yesterday, who, by the way, finished that really well. Another thumping shot into the top corner. So he's got those sides to him. I think he's quite humble, quite selfless, and he's been great to watch, hasn't he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he just looks lovely. He just looks like such a lovely bloke. I've no idea what he's like, but I think the way he's played with that sort of smile on his face as well, and he seems to have just enjoyed every minute of his football, and it all seems so natural. And you just almost think, you know, in whatever you do with your life and whatever your thing is, to be able to go out and do it in a way that just looks so easy and enjoyable, it's quite an enviable thing to imagine. I can't imagine that anyway. I think the thing is, will he do it again? Can he sustain it? All that stuff. It's hard to imagine that he's going to suddenly score 8 goals next season. Or, I mean, he might not get, you know, in the 40s and what have you next year, but he certainly, there's no reason why he's not going to get in the 30s or late 20s, and even that is a very
the second
very
season
fantastic
syndrome.
Like that Marcus return. Stewart. I don't think anybody yeah. should be expecting him to get exactly the same number
You're
of
right.
goals.
But you see, Marcus Stewart had that second season syndrome, didn't he? It's the idea that pundits will say, well, people will have found him out by now, because you could have sort of 10 games in have noticed that he was doing something quite good and had a go at stopping it. And actually, Barry, quite important for Liverpool to have top four, so that when they go into the Champions League final, it is, there's obviously some pressure on that game anyway, but it's not win at all costs. It's win at a lot of Liverpool fans crowing about it for years.
Win at a lot of costs if you're yeah. trying to get to Kiev, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That is another point, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. Does it take any pressure off? You're still playing Real Madrid in a Champions League final. It's...
I think it does a tiny bit.
I think the more important thing is that they go there feeling like they're on form. You know, the fact that they finished the season yeah. on a high in terms of their performance, that they all were quite bright, that they were all still wanting goals and passing the ball and playing fast football. I think that's much more important in a way.
I don't get this thing that being in next season's Champions League is more important than winning this one when you're in the final against
Real Madrid.
No,
I don't think it is. But I think
that seems to be the impression a lot of people are conveying. Oh, we must get in next season's first before worrying about winning this season. So, you know, you're 90 minutes away from winning it.
But if you're not...
Who cares about next season?
Well, because if you're not in the Champions League next year, people like Mo Salah might go, well, I might toddle off to Barcelona.
Well, you might toddle off anyway.
Well, he might.
It's not as if Liverpool players don't regularly toddle off to Spanish clubs.
Talking of teams who aren't in the Champions League next season, Chelsea aren't, and they made sure of it, going down 3-0 at St James's Park. Antonio Conte won't be there, will he?
Next season, no, surely not. And I mean, on that performance, you'd wonder whether he'd still be there for the cup final. But the weird thing in recent weeks has been Chelsea's attitude, I think. I mean, Conte was quite scathing about it after they played Southampton the other week, when they went a goal down and then Giroud came on, didn't he, and turned it round, and Conte said afterwards, basically, our attitude wasn't good enough. And then yesterday, after they got lamped at Newcastle, he said, we have 6 days to change our desire and our will to fight. And if you look at any team Antonio Conte has ever managed, it's had that desire, it's had that will to fight. It's been aggressive, really. So what has happened in... You have to look at Chelsea, I think, and the whole ethos and culture of the club and the recycling of managers every 2 years. People in the club know it's going to happen, transmits to the players, presumably. Conte hasn't exactly ever put that to bed in his press conferences ever since, like, before Christmas. And you think it's not a healthy environment, is it? Because people presumably get halfway through the second season of a cycle and know the cycle is about to end. And it seems to me like a few guys are down tools a bit. And I think Chelsea need to change their culture in terms of planning, in terms of allowing a bit of stability for building.
But they might say, you know, we win stuff with this weird culture, this weird, inconsistent, lack of continuity culture that Chelsea has been actually, in relative terms, phenomenally successful in the last 15 years. I don't know if it can be now because of the way other clubs are.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting point. And, you know, what you said earlier, Max, about, you know, put yourself in the mindset of a Chelsea fan. Like, you know, you can have an incredible year and win massive trophies and then have a really rubbish year the next year, and it's up and down and up and down. And it's quite odd. But I guess they seem to be, Chelsea fans I know seem to be quite used to it. Like, that's just how it is. But I think what's maybe different about now compared to the kind of earlier years of Chelsea being like this is that there is technically more competition, I think, at the top, where we, you know, really did used to feel like a top four, and it was probably quite hard to miss out on the top four for the old-fashioned top four, you know, 5 to 10 years ago. It very much is... or feels much more like a 5 or 6 now. I mean, Arsenal didn't make much of a fist of it this year, but if they buck up their ideas, then you would probably think going into next season it ought to be 4 from 6 again. And it's quite difficult to call who those apart from Manchester City at the moment, who the other three might be if everybody pulls themselves together. There's no reason why any of that other five can't make the other three spots.
Does the fact that even Antonio Conte cannot get anything out of these guys currently show something a bit toxic going on?
Well, Conte complained as well about Michael Emanalo going, didn't he? Earlier this season, in October, I think, who interestingly, before he left, was sort of a figure of quite a lot of criticism from some people. And then he left and everyone realised actually he might have been quite good at doing whatever he was doing. A lot has been spoken about who's going to get the Arsenal job. No one's really mentioned who might come into Chelsea.
Sarri at Napoli appears to be the favourite. I'm not sure if that's just because he issued a rather craven come and get me plea last week, and there's a suggestion he and Conte could actually swap jobs, and Conte would go and take over in Naples.
They swap houses and everything.
That'd be handy, wouldn't
it? Very useful.
So he's a big name manager that Chelsea haven't yet employed, so you know, why not?
Just on the house swap thing, not that I've been having to write a lot about Arsene Wenger lately, but one of the stories I quite liked was when he went first to Japan, he moved into Gary Lineker's old pad, and Gary Lineker's fax machine still had, you know, Gary Lineker's name sort of printed on it. It was obviously very difficult to change that kind of thing in that era, so a lot of communication in those days, especially internationally, used to come by fax. So Arsene Wenger used to get all these important messages coming through to Gary Lineker.
And was he writing as Gary Lineker? You could have a lot of fun with that, couldn't you?
What was happening back in those days? Gary sending people messages saying my toe really hurts. Anyway, Chelsea last played in the Europa League in the 2012-13 season when they ended up winning the trophy under the guidance of Rafa Benitez. Nick, do you want to do one sentence on what a great job Rafa has done at St James's Park?
Really good job. They've seen out the season well, finished 10th, I think, didn't they? And with a squad that on paper doesn't excite you very much, he's really producing something there. And much like other managers we've just spoken about, he's now going to his chairman and seeing what money he can get hold of for next season and making veiled threats here and there. But he's another one who I think, push comes to shove, he'll stay and try and build something there.
Few people, Amy, saying Benitez to Arsenal.
I've seen that mentioned. And in many ways, from the noises and the whispers that you hear, what Arsenal are looking for is sort of the antithesis. So if they were looking for someone with experience to come in and organise them and sort them out, and you look at the makeup of the squad and the specific issues that they've had this year, what Arsenal could do with is somebody with the incentive and experience and motivation to come in specifically to organise a defensive side and tactical side of a team. However, the signs seem to be that they want someone young, fresh, not necessarily experienced, that's going to build without making too much demands financially. Even if some people from the outside might put two and two together and think, oh, Benitez would go in and go do a good job at Arsenal, I don't think that that is what the board are looking for.
Before the pod started, we were discussing Mikel Arteta's possible appointment. How are you feeling about, how would you feel about that?
I think you don't want to be damning somebody before they've even got a job, so you have to put it into that kind of perspective.
You're saying Arteta out, aren't you? Arteta must go.
There's an airplane flying above this building as we speak.
Kroenke, you're next, it had, didn't it? That was the good banner yesterday. But there has to be some reservations about appointing someone who's never managed, ever. I mean, I think, without putting too fine a point on it, it would seem like quite a useful thing to be able to assess someone's capacity for the job based on some stuff they've already done. So just for that reason alone, you know, it may well be he will turn out to be one of the world's great coaches. I just think at this particular moment in time for Arsenal Football Club, with what they need in the post-Wenger years right now, to give this job and this role and these shoes to fill and this environment to someone who's never managed a game of football in their life seems really risky.
I mean, he's had the best grounding I think you could possibly have. I mean, he's good mates with Pochettino. He's got Bielsa on speed dial. He's obviously had this year now with Guardiola and has worked for so long under Wenger. And I think this is the sort of moment he has been preparing for a very long time. I interviewed him 3 or 4 years ago in quite great depth about what he expected from his future managerial career. And I won't go into it all now, but he was very interesting on the sort of team he would create. And he said that his teammates at Arsenal kept going up to him all the time and saying, Mickey, when are you going to be a manager? When are you going to be a manager? And I think he's been cut out for that from a very early age. The question is that if Arsenal didn't take him now and he went somewhere else and thrived, you've missed your chance, haven't you?
There's still a massive risk to take. You know, you might be good, you might be great one day. So let's do it now, even though this is blatantly not the right time to do it. It just seems a kind of cockamamie way
around. Why isn't it the
right
time to do it? Because if he fails, get someone else.
Look,
Arsenal fans at the moment. Well, sorry, you're an Arsenal fan, so I'm not going to claim to speak in your behalf. But they just want something different. If it's different and it doesn't work out, then try another different thing. I think it's a free swing.
Well, I mean, I think whatever comes is going to be different. It doesn't matter who you choose. But I think you just have to look at what the squad is right now. What is available to strengthen that squad, and Arsenal, from what they've been briefing and making it pretty clear, there's not a huge amount of money. Then, you know, Stan Kroenke is not going to he's never put his hand in his pocket, so he's not going to start now. He's not suddenly going to say, well, hey, Mr. New Manager, guess what? Have 200 million quid and see what you can do with it. That's not happening. So the new person has to more or less deal with what they have and whatever business they can do on a modest budget in the summer, in a World Cup summer and a truncated summer. So there's not that much room for manoeuvre. So if you look at any idiot knows Arsenal could do with being tightened up at the back, number one, day one, first thing you do. And also they need a bit of motivation. They need somebody with some authority who's going to get hold of, to go back to the old Guardiola line, get that hunger going in their eyes. There's been a bit of complacency around that place for a while.
Presuming Arteta wouldn't be able to do these
I'm
things?
I'm not presuming he can't do it. I'm saying we don't know that he can.
I
so if you try somebody who, you try and appoint somebody who has some managerial experience and you know if they've got these kind of qualities in their armoury, okay, then you're still giving that person a free swing, but you've got some knowledge. This way, it's just...
I'm with you, Amy. He hasn't managed a game. Merce took Walsall to third for a bit, and then back down. He did play cricket on a Friday, so that might be an issue.
It's different for me because I don't care if Arteta succeeds or fails. In fact, part of me would like to see Arsenal plummet down the table just because it would be funny, no matter who takes over. But I'd be prepared to take a chance on it.
I think a lot of these player to manager transitions founder primarily because it's difficult to hold the respect of your former teammates or something like that when you go into the dressing room. In Arteta's case, I don't think that would be a problem. I think he's got a bit of gravitas about him. People might say things about his hair or something like that, but they won't look down at him.
It is a conversation we may have again. Producer Jonathan says apparently we have to talk about some other things that have happened, and we will start part two with being nostalgic about Arsene Wenger. This is the Guardian Football Weekly. It's part two. You'll have noticed that because we just finished part one and now we're talking again. On the 22nd of May, we have a live show, Barry, fresh from our Scandinavian success in Copenhagen last Thursday. We'll take all our Danish-based gags and repeat them on stage to people in London.
Okay.
Are you in?
Yeah.
Who's with us? Wilson and Ronay again?
I think so.
So, the Emmanuel Centre on the 22nd of May. Come, please, because it's nice when there's lots of people there. And we'll have a nice time and we'll talk to you afterwards. Especially like the Danish man who at 5-1 gave me a very serious debrief of why
because we're a bit silly, he listens to the other lot. Everyone else is really like nice and happy and saying thanks for coming. And then I got like a good 20-minute debrief of the things we should have done. But thanks for listening anyway. And thanks for coming. So, Amy, Arsene Wenger's last ever game for Arsenal. How are you feeling in your heart?
It does feel weird. And I was at the very first game. I covered that for The Observer as a Cub-ish reporter. I think I'd been around about 6 months on the Obs at that point. So it feels quite odd because virtually my entire writing life for a newspaper has coincided with one manager being on my beat, if you like. So I don't think there are many other journalists probably in the world that can go through nearly a quarter of a century covering, you know, the same man in charge of their club. Obviously, the Manchester guys had that for a while with Sir Alex Ferguson. But yeah, so it feels really strange because I haven't even had that much time before Wenger when I was doing a lot of writing either. I was just an idiot at that point, or more of an idiot. Being football, things move really quickly. So you process this kind of great hurrah, and then it's, as was just happening, you're quite quickly into what's happening next. So that's one side of it. But I think my overriding feeling, when I go back to that very, very first game at Blackburn away, the thing I remember about it in 1996 was we were sitting in the press area at Ewood Park after the game. Arsenal won 2-0, Ian Wright scored twice, and in came Arsene Wenger for his first post-match press conference. Looking back, it wasn't particularly interesting what he had to say. He was probably a bit cautious, the first one in his new country, in his new language and so on. I think he might have said something about mental strength, but not much else. And then we sat there, and in came Ray Harford, who was manager of Blackburn at the time, and going through a really bad period. I'm not sure they'd even won a game all season. They'd been recently champions. They'd really fallen off a cliff. Form was terrible. They were all booing in the crowd. It was quite a toxic atmosphere. Fans were staying away. It was all these kind of things that sort of echoes of what had been happening a bit lately at Arsenal. And poor Ray Harford looked grey and drawn and awful, you know, having to face the reality of the fact that he was about to get the sack, which he did. And if anything, I'm so pleased for Wenger, the man, that he didn't end that way, because he could have done.
Mm.
It could have easily been one day you're sitting here and you're talking about the end of Wenger, and it had all gone horribly wrong, and it was that difficult period, and you know, the end, like happens at most clubs. But the way things actually turned out, and I was so surprised that they made the announcement when they did, rather than at the end of the season, it did enable him and the club, and the fans and the greater English football public to, you know, show some really warm admiration for him. And for, I think it's been quite cathartic. It's been quite unusual, really, that you have a situation where a manager's going and everyone gets a chance to say a really proper, jolly, happy, meaningful farewell. And I think he's enjoyed it more than I thought he would have done, because normally he hates the limelight and he would probably run a mile from, you know, I saw him yesterday sort of striding up to the away end and then this flourish of the bow. It was like, blimey, you know, and you just don't expect to see something like that from him, that sort of slightly showy moment of outward emotion. So I think it was great that he got to go out on in a warm, happy way. The best bit was when the Huddersfield fans sang, possibly, you know, with some justification, "You two-faced bastards, you know, you wanted him out." And I think the Arsenal fans replied with, "Herbert Chapman, he left because you're shit." And just, you know, in this era of modern football bants.
80 years ago. Yeah. 90. But he's, you know, Arsene's never been that given to looking back, has he? He's always so intent on not reflecting too much and looking forwards. But yesterday he allowed himself before kickoff. I think as they warmed up, he sat in the dugout for a while, didn't he? He was like talking to the club photographers and people who walked past and taking the scene in. And then he said afterwards that he'd walked into the away dressing room before the game, and there was a photo of Herbert Chapman, and Herbert Chapman was smiling on him. And I just thought that was really nice. I think Arsene both appreciated and wanted that bit of circularity that came with the end and tied things up, that he was finishing.
Is that why he lost the semi-final to Atletico? Because so he could finish with this perfectly tied thing with Herbert Chapman.
With the photograph.
I think it's called a silver lining.
22 years, 1,235 games, 716 wins, 2,298 goals, one Arsene Wenger. Yeah, it's strange for any Arsenal fan who's 26 or 27 and younger. Literally have no concept that a football club could possibly exist without Arsene Wenger.
They could just be thankful they missed the George Graham years.
Are you kidding?
Huddersfield, David Wagner didn't really comment on his future. Rumours of Leicester City?
He was evasive, to put it kindly, afterwards. I think his chairman, Dean Hoyle, came out on the pitch at half-time and gave an interview where he said, I know David Wagner's going to be our manager next season. And in the final question of the post-match press conference, Wagner was asked about that. And Wagner said, in a jokey voice, he's putting himself under a bit of pressure there, isn't he? And then got the hell out of there ASAP. And he's normally quite a straight answerer of questions, Wagner.
Well, I mean, the key whenever. Is, isn't it? If you're a manager, you have to time your jumps at the right time, because his stock is so high, and it's nothing to say that he could sack 10 games into next season at Huddersfield if they don't start as well.
You do, and I was thinking this yesterday, because it was a lovely, as I think Amy said earlier, celebratory atmosphere there, the fans and everyone was in a fantastic mood, but staying in the top flight, they will never celebrate it like that again unless they have an incredible great escape from somewhere. That will not happen again, not in the current cycle anyway. So, you know, the next step is probably to lose yourself in that morass of mid-table teams we've spoken about and don't like very much.
So that's the aim, that's where you want to be.
But yeah, he's at the sweet spot now, and I think he knows it, and I think there's never been a big sense for me that he's going to be there for years. I think bigger clubs in Germany are interested. People, as you say, have mentioned Leicester, and it wouldn't surprise me if he knew this was the time to jump.
Manchester United 1, Watford 0. They followed up that goalless draw at West Ham. United. Marty says, just seen Michael Carrick's pass for the goal on Match of the Day. Get him on that plane, the World Cup. It was his 464th and final Manchester United appearance. And it's interesting when we discuss Michael Carrick that the first question is, I never really played it. You can't appreciate that's an extraordinary number of games to play for Manchester United in such a successful era. And before we stay, but should he have played more in an England shirt? Amy, should he have played more in an England shirt?
Probably, yes. I mean, I sometimes wonder, God, this may be opening up a can of worms here, but how much certain players for certain big clubs are really that bothered about something like that. I think that we get, you know, have this big idea that playing for your country is like, you know, the be all and end all of everything. But I think if you play for a massive club, especially as you're getting a bit older in your career, sometimes that's fine and that's enough, and you don't beat yourself up about the fact that you're not playing for your country. And you're not, you know, a lot of international football is not that much fun. If you speak to players, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but that's the reality. It is their job, and going away and being in hotels and travelling and blah blah blah, and it's not always,
well, I suppose if you're a footballer, it's very boring. You know, being at a major tournament is really boring because you're cloistered in a hotel most of the time. It's a very nice hotel, but you're can't really leave, you know. And the England team make life very difficult for themselves by, you know, going around in big coaches with security goons and tinted windows, and you know they don't get out and mingle with fans or whatever. You know, I don't know if it's because they feel they can't or because they just can't because they get mobbed. And it It must be very, very tedious.
Mm. Carrick said it was almost depressing. And,
is he going to look back on his career and think, you know? No, I don't think he is. I think he's going to think, quite rightly, I've had an absolutely sensational career.
He was a brilliant...
I should just qualify. It's particularly boring if you're doing with a team that isn't going to win stuff, you know. If you're winning things or getting deep into tournaments, you know, you're probably prepared to put up with the boredom, but otherwise it's just a complete drag.
Yeah, he's had a great career. He made his debut in West Ham's 1-1 Intertoto Cup draw against Jokerit, wherever on earth that is.
Finland.
Thank you, Nick. Yeah. 706 club appearances, 34 goals, 34 caps for England. I mean, it would have taken a brave manager not to pick Lampard or Gerrard as well. Like, that would have, whether they worked or not ever, it would have been difficult to do that, to go into a game and not win it and not pick them. But he was just a lovely passer of a football, Nick.
He still is, yeah. And I quite like that he's now being absorbed into Jose Mourinho's boot room in the absence of Rui Faria, isn't he, who I think is leaving as the assistant. I think Mourinho said that as soon as Carrick's done his badges and all that kind of thing, he'll pretty much make him his number two or something close to it. And I think that'll be a good influence and a good bit of continuity on the training pitch there. He's got a lot to pass on.
He has to go away and learn how to badger forth officials.
Burnley 1, Bournemouth 2. Very late goal for Callum Wilson. Burnley going into Europe, which we've mentioned before, but great achievements. Crystal Palace finished off with a 2-0 victory over West Brom. And Roy Hodgson did a tremendous job. No points, no goals in 7 games. Their stats when Zaha plays and he doesn't are quite extraordinary, actually. Other players have played well. You know, Townsend's done well, Milivojevic has done well, but...
You wonder if Zaha's... You know, we talk about people on the move, because obviously he had that experience going to Manchester United. It didn't quite work out for him, but now that bit older, that bit wiser, that bit more developed, whether someone else is going to have a second go at Zaha.
West Ham beat Everton 3-1.
I thought you meant West Ham were going to have a go at Zaha.
They will. All the fans were singing about Big Sam at the West Ham Everton game. A £12.5 million deal has now been agreed in principle for Rooney to move to DC United when the MLS transfer window opens in July. But apparently Everton may now ask him to stay, according to some reports. What do you think, Nick?
I mean, it'd be nice to know who'd be in charge there next season before anyone makes their mind up, wouldn't it? I mean, Big Sam doesn't sound very confident that he'll be there much longer. The favourites are Paulo Fonseca of Shakhtar and the currently unemployed Marco Silva. And I think surely either of them would want to have some sort of say in whether they still have somebody as influential and as prominent as Rooney hanging around.
If I gave you the job, would you keep him?
No.
You're ruthless, Ames, aren't you?
I'd want to make them. I just want to make them that bit more dynamic than they currently are, and I don't see what his place would be. You've got Gylfi Sigurdsson coming back from injury. You've got, you know, the fabled team of slow number tens that they built up last summer. If there's a good offer for Rooney,
if you'd almost want him to go before you got there, because then you wouldn't be blamed with letting an Everton legend go.
You don't want that on your hands, do you?
Difficult to know if Rooney had a good or bad seasons, kind of like Manchester United syndrome. Were they good this season? Were they not? Because he scored arguably the goal of the season against West Ham. He was the club's top scorer, but then they didn't have a very good season. And he is undeniably, you know, slow and not as good as he used to be. But I think I would probably get rid of. And, you know, he might enjoy life in DC United. I believe DC United are bottom of their division and not very good.
They're moving to a new stadium.
Right.
So they want one of those designated marquee signings. I'm thoroughly behind him doing it. You mentioned that goal, Barry. Stealing from Match of the Day, goals of the season. They went Charlie Daniels' volley against Man City, Sofiane Boufal's ridiculous run against West Brom, Rooney's from the halfway line, which he struck beautifully. The pile drivers of Obiang against Spurs, or Wanyama against Liverpool. Salah's mazy run against Spurs. Sane's finishing off an amazing move from Man City. Or Jamie Vardy's volley, the ball over the top, left foot. If you could vote for one.
I liked Wanyama's goal at Liverpool.
just because of its brutalness.
Because it was brutal. It was the hardest shot since, I think, Stephen Reid hit that goal that bounced right out of the net again. It was just like absolutely the more subtle goals. And I think if we were talking about artistry, I'd say maybe that Sané goal. But for pure emphatic, would you look at that?
Yeah,
I'd say Wanyama.
And completely unexpected as well. The winner was, producer Jonathan says, Jamie Vardy, which technically was a brilliant finish, but wasn't as fun. Right, the playoffs, the championship playoffs, two excellent headers, mean that Aston Villa and Derby take one goal leads into the second leg. On Friday night, Derby beat Fulham 1-0. Cameron Jerome with a bullet in the first half. Fulham had chances. Second leg is tonight at the Cottage. Nick, do you think Fulham will... They've got enough to get through that, haven't they?
I mean, on recent years' evidence, you could back either team to make a bit of a mess of it. I'd love for them to do it. They play lovely football under Jokanović, who I think Amy's interviewed him once or twice, so maybe better place than me. But I've seen him play a bit and love the way they play. Love the extra little bit of snap and snarl they've added up top with Mitrovic, who's been on great form. But I think Derby have got a lot of street smarts in that squad. They're quite experienced, a little bit nasty. I'm not a massive fan, but I just look at how Fulham play and how Derby are set up and think they will grit it out and get to Wembley.
Villa won 1-0 at Middlesbrough. Miller Jedinek with a lovely run, near post header into the corner. If you were going to pick one of those sides out, it would be Fulham, wouldn't it? I mean, they're the most interesting and the most exciting.
And in that old-fashioned way, they finished third, didn't they?
They did, yeah.
Maybe give them...
You can have it. Amy's just giving you promotion. yesterday, Shrewsbury booked their place in the League One playoff final with a 1-0 win over Charlton. Great run down the right from Sean Wally, finished off by Carlton Morris. Game also featured, I don't know if any of you have seen this, Ben Amos making a frankly ridiculous save where... He's facing the wrong way and dives full length, guessing because he's had to run back, and he's basically facing the goal and guessing where someone shoots. It's like a computer game glitch. It's amazing.
It was amazing, and I mean, that's a shame for Lee Bowyer, obviously, who's not been going that long in charge of Charlton, and for them. But should maybe say we're for Paul Hurst of Shrewsbury, done a fantastic job there. You'd normally consider them to be relegation candidates, and I think he had them leading the table for quite a while at the start of the season, and we got a little glimpse of them against West Ham when they showed up quite well. But you wonder whether a smaller team that gets to the playoffs like that might run out of steam. They haven't. They've got a couple of great players. They've got a good midfielder, I think, on loan from Norwich, Ben Godfrey. Carlton Morris, I think, scored the goal the other day, and he's on loan from them too. Really nice group of players, and he's a very good, tactically flexible manager. Should get a bigger job. Well done.
They will play either Scunthorpe or Rotherham, who drew 2-2 at Glanford Park in the other game. Cameron McGeehan getting a late equaliser for Scunny. The second leg's on Wednesday. In League Two, it was Coventry 1, Notts County 1. Cov hit the post early on. Notts County scored with a lovely finish from Jonathan Fort. Through the legs, volley. Coventry equalised with a penalty that was a bizarre decision where the fullback just kicked the ball and the Coventry player fell over. The ref gave a penalty late on. So that's 1-1. The other game also level after the first leg. Lincoln 0, Exeter 0. Matt Reid, that big number 9, hit the bar with a header for Lincoln, about as close as anyone got. Second legs on Thursday. Nick writes, some Tranmere love would be great on today's pod. Really enjoyed Barry's write-up yesterday. What a game. What a weekend. Up the bleeping whites' heart. Boreham Wood 1, Tranmere Rovers 2. Baz, you were there.
Yeah, it was at Wembley. Probably shouldn't have been. Only 16,000 up in the National Stadium for that. It, you know, looked very empty. And I think maybe a stadium of the size of Craven Cottage or Sellers Park or Turf Moor maybe would be better for that game. But Boreham Wood, admittedly, you know, they do deserve their day out in Wembley. But I suspect even the teams themselves would prefer to play in a more compact surroundings. Boreham Wood were huge underdogs going into this, but you know, their average gate's about 600 people, and they got stroke of luck because Liam Roydash, the Tranmere fullback, was sent off, gone in 50 seconds or slightly fewer than 50 seconds for a studs up lunge, and the ref, you know, gave him a red card, which was thoroughly deserved, but you don't see refs giving them out that early usually. Andy Cook then put Tranmere a goal ahead after a few minutes, and during those celebrations, Josh Ginnelly got hit by a bottle. Tranmere midfielder, he got hit by a bottle thrown from the Boreham Wood end and was quite obviously dazed and maybe a bit concussed. It's a bugbear of mine, players don't get taken off when they're clearly concussed, but anyway. He went off 30 minutes later and was replaced by Connor Jennings, who ended up having a huge influence on the game. And so, and then Boreham Wood equalised in the eighth of 6 minutes of added time at the end of the first half. So Tranmere were left with 10 men, used all their subs by half time, and they still managed to win. Scored James Norwood scored from a Jennings cross. 10 minutes to go. It was very entertaining, and I think if Tranmere, if it had gone to extra time, I think Tranmere would have lost because they were just absolutely dead on their feet, having played so long with 10 men. And Boreham Wood, they were a bit more streetwise than Boreham Wood, who I think were punching above their weight. But yeah, it was a good game.
Well done, Tranmere. Fitbar. Breaking news, Scott Arfield flew into Glasgow Airport this morning ahead of joining Rangers. The midfielder's agreed a 4-year deal and passed a medical. He is Steven Gerrard's first signing of the Rangers revolution. And there was some interesting stuff over the weekend too, Baz, wasn't there?
Yeah, Hibs and Rangers drew 5-5 at Easter Road.
I love the end of the season.
Oh, yeah. Rangers were 3-0 down after 21 minutes, then went 5-3 up. On the 70-minute mark. And then Jamie McLaren scored 2 to make it 5-5. Neil Lennon, the Hibs manager, celebrated the equaliser by running onto the pitch with his arms spread like an aeroplane and was subsequently sent to the stands, even though it was the 90th minute. He has a 2-match suspension hanging over him for a previous misdemeanour, but he's urged the Scottish FA not to trigger it because he said it was all just good fun and the Rangers fans have been calling him a Fenian bastard all through the game anyway, so, you know, they had it coming. So whether they'll share his view remains to be seen.
He could just say, I was just channeling my inner Jan Agerfjordtoft.
Or John Fashanu.
Yeah.
And then at Celtic Park, Celtic were presented with their trophy after they'd lost to Aberdeen, who secured second place again for the third or fourth year in a row. That was an interesting game too. There was a red card for Aberdeen fullback Shay Logan at the final whistle. He went over to celebrate in front of Celtic's fans. Some of the Celtic players took exception to this. Him and Mikael Lustig got in a bit of a strawmation, and he shoved Lustig in the face. And then Dedrick Boyata threw the ball at him. Someone else threw the ball at him, and he was given the red card, and he was given it the biggin as he was walking off the pitch, had to be escorted off. And he's a bit of previous with Celtic fans because 4 years ago, there was a fellow, a Bulgarian, Alexander Tonev, winger, played a few games with Celtic, and he was done for racially abusing Logan, and he appealed, got a 7-match ban. Celtic appealed and the ban was upheld, and Celtic's players at the time, some of whom were still with the club, insisted Tonev had done nothing wrong. Logan insists he'd used the C word, called him a black C, and it was very unpleasant at the time, so I suspect there's still bad blood over that, and that's why he was taunting the Celtic fans. But anyway, he will get a 2 or 3 match ban for that red card, and his comments on Twitter afterwards would suggest he could not care less.
Ah, marvellous. Social media is such a
yeah.
It's a great place, isn't it, to vent when you're in a bit of a bad mood.
Anyway, just to wrap up, so Celtic champions, Aberdeen and Rangers second and third. Partick Thistle beat Dundee to avoid automatic relegation and set up a 2-legged playoff with Livingston. Ross County are gone down out of the Premier League, and St Mirren have got automatic promotion from the Championship.
And there's Scotland. We will begin part three in Spain, where Barcelona are not invincible. Does that mean they are vincible?
Yes.
Barcelona are vincible. Back in a second. Welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Part three begins in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous, thanks. I was not expecting Barcelona to lose to Levante.
No, I think most people weren't. I think it was plausible, though. If you look at the way, you know, the way it happened, not the score, obviously, that kind of scoreline and the craziness of the game wasn't predictable. But Barcelona losing was not quite as implausible as it looks. Of course, they come off the back of the Clásico, having got through that, and then they're only two games away from an unbeaten season. And you think, right, okay, it's done now. And I think that's part of the problem. And the kind of the natural climb down off the back of the Clásico against a side that have improved enormously under new manager. I think I'm right in saying, but I'd have to double check this. But anyway, take it as read. I think they've won 8 of the last 10 with the new manager, Levante, playing really, really well at home. Barcelona left Leo Messi out of the squad. They're going to a friendly in South Africa midweek, which sort of suggests that the priorities have been a little bit turned upside down. They started with Tom and Jerry at centre-back, with Thomas Vermaelen and Jerry Mina, and they were pretty awful. But admittedly, it still is a surprise. And they were 2-0 down at 2-1 just before half-time. You think, OK, well, maybe now it gets sorted out. You get three goals inside 7-8 minutes of the second half. Suddenly they're 5-1 down. They get it back to 5-4 with 20 minutes to go. And you think, they're going to turn this around. They're going to get away with this. And it didn't happen. And as I say, Levante, brilliant. And by the way, Boateng, who scored yesterday, scored a hat-trick. Mm-hmm. That means that 50% of all of his goals this season have been against Barcelona.
Impressive. And nobody scored a brace against Barcelona before him. Is that right?
That probably is right. I mean, you've caught me on the hop, I must admit, but that probably is right. I can't think of many teams that have scored two, and certainly not the same player. They had 2-2 draw with Madrid, two different scorers, 2-2 with Celta, two different scorers, 2-2 with Seville. I think that was two different scorers as well. So yeah, that is probably right.
And how's it gone down? Because I remember you saying earlier in the season that whether Barcelona remained unbeaten wasn't such a big deal because of what had happened to them in the Champions League. But presumably, this close, people had started to really get excited about it.
Yeah, and I think in a way, I mean, slightly revised that in the sense that it's not a big deal because of what happened in the Champions League. I think in a way what happened in the Champions League made it a big deal as the season went on, in the sense that what happened in Rome will always kind of mark this season. I know this sounds ridiculous when a team wins a double, but it would always mark this season. There was always a sense of, yeah, but look, when it really, really mattered, you just weren't good enough. And yet, I think, had they completed an unbeaten season for the first time, at least the first time since 1932, back when it was only 18 games, so the first time with a league, you know, a proper big league, then there would have been a sense that, all right, this is genuinely historic. This doesn't necessarily make up for the way they were knocked out in Rome, and certainly doesn't make up for the way they were knocked out in Rome if Real Madrid go and win the Champions League. But it would have said that this is more than just winning the league title. This is something genuinely special. And so I think it did matter. And as I say, I think it probably mattered more because of Rome, rather than not mattering because of Rome.
How did Atletico warm up for the Europa League final?
Well, the surprise, I suppose, in a way, was that they warmed up by playing pretty much the strongest team they could. They played against a Getafe side who are very, very tough, very aggressive. I suppose, in a way, you could say they're a bit like Atletico, and it was that kind of game. And obviously, Atletico, who dish it out quite a bit, suddenly when it was kind of proposed from the other team, is a bit of like a moment in which you're thinking, hang on, what's this all about? They won 1-0, which is a good result and puts them in a very strong position now to finish ahead of Real Madrid. Obviously, it's not a huge issue whether they finish ahead of Madrid, but that kind of helps. And they got through it without any injuries, which I suppose is the main thing. I mean, they're the shortest squad in the first division at the moment in terms of number of first team players. They've been, I think, running on empty a little bit in recent weeks, and probably this isn't the ideal preparation for the final, but that's what they chose to do and they won it. And so I think they'll go to Lyon and still feel like they should be favourites for it.
Yeah, obviously playing Marseille on Wednesday night. Anything else of note, Sid?
Well, you've got Gareth Bale scoring an absolutely brilliant goal, scoring two, but one of them is an absolutely brilliant goal. And of course, the debate has now started up again. Should he get a place in the final? My suspicion is that it doesn't matter what he does, he's not going to start in the final. But I think what he may be, he may well achieve with all of this is making himself much, much more likely to get called upon at some stage in the final. And of course, I wouldn't put it past him to come on and win the game for them.
And do you expect him to be there next season?
If If I had to put my money on something right now, I would say no. But it's not an easy departure to manage. You have to find a club that will pay enormous amounts of money for him, a huge salary for him, that will pay the kind of money that Madrid would accept, that will put in a bid that Madrid can, if you like, kind of emotionally and politically accept. You know, this has to be a really good deal for them. There aren't that many clubs out there that can pay that kind of money. There aren't many clubs out there that want him, of the ones that can pay for it, that have a natural space in the team for him. So I think it's quite difficult to see how the departure happens. But I think if there is a way of making it happen, then I think it's a deal that both player and club would probably embrace now. But as I say, I think it's very, very difficult to make it happen.
I was reading a thing this morning in which it was said Barcelona are probably going to pay more than Antoine Griezmann's release clause to get him from Atletico. Is that just a gesture of goodwill so as to not antagonise them?
I think that response, that story is a response to the way that Atletico Madrid have responded over the last, I think it was last Monday, this time last week, when they came out and said they were sick of Barcelona's attitude, that they thought it was out of order, that they were pursuing Griezmann. And then there was a statement, I think on Tuesday or Wednesday of last week, basically saying, you know, we will take all legal action necessary. Now, obviously legal action, well, there isn't any legal action because he's got a buyout clause. That's the whole point of this. And in a sense, the kind of interpretation of tapping up goes out the window, where you have a mechanism which every player has a price. And in this particular case, in which it's a price that drops on the 1st of July to 100 million euros, in other words, Atletico Madrid have facilitated this. So for them to then complain, it kind of sits a little bit uneasily, although it is certainly true that Barcelona haven't managed it well. Now, the reason why I say this in terms of your specific point is that Barcelona would pay 100 million euros of the buyout clause, 20 million euros of that goes to Real Sociedad, his former club. The suggestion has been that Barcelona, as a way of saying to Atletico Madrid, kind of, you know, calm down, all right, we realise we overstepped the mark a bit. Look, we'll pay you the 100 million euros of his buyout clause, and as a gesture of goodwill, we will pay the 20 that Real Sociedad are due to get as well. I don't think they need to do that, but it wouldn't be the most amazing thing in the world if they did it, certainly not coming from this Barcelona board.
Sid, thanks for your time, as always.
My pleasure.
Sid Lowe, out in Spain. From there, we will go to Italy. Juve won the title. Let's get a report from Paolo Bandini.
We've known it for a week already, but we can now officially say that Juventus are champions of Italy for the seventh consecutive season. They sealed the deal with a 0-0 draw away to Roma on Sunday, in a game which sparkled briefly at the start but faded in the second half, and especially after Arjen Nainggolan was sent off. It might not be the outcome that many neutrals were hoping for after seeing Napoli topple Juve in Turin last month, but we shouldn't let the repetitive nature of Juventus' success diminish quite how extraordinary this is. No team had ever won six consecutive Scudetti before this run, and no team had ever won the double four times in a row either. So they also really did have a competition this year, and I think that's easy to overlook. Napoli beat Sampdoria on Sunday and now have 88 points, which is a club record. If they beat Crotone next weekend, they'll be the first team ever not to win Serie A with more than 90 points. Their game was actually halted in the second half on Sunday due to Sampdoria fans seeing discriminatory chants against people from Naples. The Sampdoria president, Massimo Ferrero, even walked down to have a word with the ultras during that pause. And it was actually an eventful weekend pretty much everywhere except for the Roma-Juventus game in Italy. Inter looked to have blown their shot at a Champions League place when they lost 2-1 at home to Sassuolo. But then Lazio drew with Crotone, meaning that Inter can still leapfrog Lazio into the last Champions League spot if they beat them in Rome next weekend. Milan finally sewed up their Europa League spot after drawing with Atalanta, who will also get in now, barring a defeat and a 7-goal swing between them and Fiorentina next weekend. That's all because the Viola lost 1-0 at home to Cagliari. What was supposed to be an occasion to celebrate the life of Davide Astori, who played for both clubs, instead became this furiously bad-tempered game as the Sardinians, who are themselves fighting against relegation, began the weekend in 18th place, took a 1-0 lead and clung onto it, wasting as much time as they possibly could. There were scuffles at the end of the game, and Fiorentina had both Jordan Veretout and manager Stefano Pioli sent off. Cagliari climb out of the drop zone for now. Crotone drop in, but there are only 2 points separating 14th place from 18th now, going into the final weekend.
Thank you, Paolo, for that report. Now let's go live to Archie Rintut to get the latest from Germany. Archie, how are you?
Very well, Max. Very well, after a exhilarating final Bundesliga weekend.
Yeah, scenes in Hamburg as they went down.
Yeah, the scenes which I think have gone across Europe are these of this black plume of smoke which was coming out from the end where the Hamburg Ultras were. But it doesn't really paint the full picture, because actually, given the way that Hamburg have played in the last few weeks, it was expected that they would still go down. But the majority of the fans at the stadium were booing and whistling the people who were letting off these black smoke bombs, which you would have seen. And indeed, the rows and rows of police who then came on. The game was delayed by about 15 minutes. But yes, Hamburg going down, the first time in their history. They had been the only side ever present in every Bundesliga season, but that is now no longer the case. The work that Christian Titz has done, their coach, has I think really managed to smooth over the situation a little bit more. But if you speak to Hamburg fans, a very good friend of mine is one, he was just saying that he's just happy to get it out the way as much as anything, because it's been hanging over the club for so long. Playing in the relegation playoff in two of the past four or five seasons has been something which has been very difficult to take. So it's not surprising, but yes, it finally happened on Saturday.
What are they going to do with their clock? Are they going to do it the other way around, sort of time it takes to get back there?
Well, one thing that happened on Saturday regarding the clock is that the Borussia Mönchengladbach fans, so Hamburg did end up actually winning the game 2-1, but because Wolfsburg won themselves against Cologne, it meant that Hamburg got relegated. So throughout the game, the Gladbach fans in the away end were actually unveiling a clock which was counting down towards Hamburg's relegation. As for the actual clock itself, it's thought that they might well just add another number on so that it's years since Hamburg was formed as a club. It's said to be, I think it's going to be running until June. And then something will happen with it. But the clock just kept on ticking on Saturday afternoon.
Well, keep your eyes on it, Archie. Dortmund are managerless. Who are they going to get?
Lucien Favre, former Borussia Mönchengladbach coach, current Nice coach. It's 90% of the way there. It would be very surprising if anything else was to happen at this stage. Peter Stöger, the coach who came in December after Peter Bosz's up and then very much down time at the club, announcing that he was off. But to be honest, Sebastian Rode, midfielder for Borussia Dortmund, had said as much on a talk program in Germany the weekend before against club wishes. So that didn't go down too well. But Favre is a very interesting appointment, somebody who is renowned for bringing through young players, but also I think he's had great success in the Bundesliga as well before then having periods where it's gone south at quite an alarming rate. At Borussia Mönchengladbach, they lost their first five games of the season, the worst start in their history, which saw him leave. But he more memorably brought through the likes of Marco Reus at Gladbach and a young Marc-Andre Ter Stegen. So the football that he plays is something, but I think it's the problem at Dortmund is more than just the coach at the moment. That you've got so many different problems there, and I think it's a Jurgen Klopp sized hole that they're still trying to fill, because after Thomas Tuchel left last summer, they said that decision wasn't to do with anything on the sporting side, which was basically them saying, Max, that they didn't really like him as a person. And after that, they then tried to choose people who they thought would be better to work with, but haven't been able to achieve anywhere near the same results or indeed anywhere near the same football. So it's a club which is certainly... it is going to have to change. The sporting director, Michel Tork, was saying over the weekend that big changes are needed. So I wouldn't be surprised if you do see quite a few. But one bright spot should be mentioned with Dortmund is Jadon Sancho, who has done very well on his 10 or so appearances when he has played this season. He's definitely one to watch out for next season.
And what about Wolfsburg in the relegation playoff? It wasn't that long ago that they won the league. What's happened?
Wolfsburg, a similar story. In terms of on the same lines as Hamburg, in terms of mismanagement, spent an awful lot of money on players, even in the last few years, over 100 million euros, I think, in terms of the last one and a half season. But I think losing Kevin De Bruyne obviously had a massive effect as well. Julian Draxler going didn't help, but just a real team of individuals, I would say, and with no real identification to the club, that hasn't helped things. That they've had six managers, inclusive of the manager who got them to the Champions League quarterfinals, Dieter Hecking. That that sort of inconsistency in terms of on the sideline hasn't helped. And their sporting director, Olaf Reber, who left a few weeks ago, was not able to create a squad which was all that balanced. I'd say that their squad's actually quite similar to Stoke, I think you could draw a comparison to, in that a lot of flair players there, but one that it doesn't really gel together exactly. Okay, they got over the line against Cologne, but they may actually have one or two problems against Holstein Kiel in the relegation playoff.
Archie, thank you so much. Have a delightful afternoon.
Thank you, Max. Cheers.
Thank you so much, Archie Rintut, our German correspondent from Germany to France, where Lille got their third win in a row to avoid relegation right at the end. Metz and Troyes went straight down. Toulouse will go into the relegation playoff. Paris Saint-Germain lost 2-0 in their last game of the season. Their players occupied the podium places of the Ligue 1 Player of the Season award, with Cavani and Mbappe beaten by a player who's been injured since February. Matthew says, has Neymar jumped the shark in his quest to be the most self-involved person in football by avoiding the PSG title celebrations with his team, but going to the Ligue 1 end of season awards to collect his individual award? Does the jacket he wore make the situation better or worse? Here is the jacket. Black, sort of gold, crusted.
It's quite adamant.
Yeah, sort of adamant.
Prince Charming era.
Sergeant Pepper type thing. I couldn't carry that off. I believe Neymar can. Does anybody want to mount a defence of Neymar as a man?
He seems all right to me.
Oh.
No.
No?
No, he says he's a bit fed up of all the speculation around him, doesn't he? And all the transfer stuff, and just wants to get fit for the World Cup and be a good professional and get ready for that. So I'm sure we're all behind him.
Which wants to take each game as it comes,
yeah,
doesn't he?
At the end of the day.
Yeah. In the MLS, there was the big Portland Timbers Seattle Sounders derby, and Portland won it 1-0 with a goal 5 minutes from time. Well done to them.
And well done to you for calling it the MLS.
Oh, damn it. Did I do that?
I knew you would.
Oh, there we go. All complaints from Americans below the line, please. You can tweet me direct and tell me what you think. In Feedback Corner, there was a discussion of making the last day of the Premier League more exciting by putting every player's smallest person in goal, just to see what would happen. I mean, there were plenty of goals anyway. Steve says, at Leicester v Shrewsbury, the 6th of March, 1982, FA Cup quarter-final, Leicester lost Mark Wallington to a foul by Chick Bates. It ended the former's run of 333 consecutive games. Alan Young, a centre-forward, went in goal. He got injured, so they put Steve Linex, a 5'7" right-winger, in goal. Fortunately, Alan Young recovered from whatever injury he had and went back in goal. Leicester were 2-1 down, and they went on to win 5-2. So well done to them. They lost to Spurs in the semi-final. And Mike, who met us in Copenhagen, Barry, made a personal request for us to end the pod by saying goodnight to his kids, Alexander and Christian. And I think, Baz, you have the most laconic, sleep-inducing voice of everyone. If you could say goodnight.
Goodnight, Alexander. Goodnight, Christian. Sleep tight. And look out for that big monster on your bed.
All right. Amy, thanks for your time.
Oh, it's been emotional.
Nick, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Baz.
You're welcome.
Back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.